Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Coming up on today's program, From Death to Life, a leading anti-death penalty activist in the US and a Catholic convert talks about how his views changed dramatically after he became a prison director and had to supervise executions there. And a marriage lifeline. We find out about a special church-sponsored program that helps couples whose marriage is heading for the rocks. Today, the United States is the only Western democratic nation that imposes the death penalty on its citizens. But while around 2 out of 3 Americans currently support capital punishment in cases where a person is convicted of murder, there has been a sharp fall in the number of death sentences handed down and in the number of executions eventually carried out. One of the US's leading campaigners against the death penalty is Ron McAndrew, who grew up as a strong supporter of capital punishment. McAndrew's views on the death penalty changed dramatically after he served as director of the state prison in Florida, where his job included supervising executions of those on death row. He began by telling us why the death penalty fails to act as a deterrent and reduce levels of violent crime in his country.
I believe that the death penalty increases murders. We know this from the European example, where you do not have the death penalty and you have much less murders than you do in the United States. The death penalty is not a deterrent to murder. It is not a deterrent to any form of crime. It is simply a barbaric politician's tool.
McAndrew went on to explain why he supported the death penalty when younger. And that's why he ended up taking the job as director or warden of the state prison in Florida in 1996.
I grew up in a conservative, very rural country area of North Carolina. I was raised by conservative grandparents who supported the death penalty like everybody else in our community. It was just a very natural thing to support. If you kill someone, you should be killed. I mean, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. The biblical quote was quoted constantly. I found myself one day being asked to go to Florida State Prison as the new warden in 1996. The secretary of the Florida Department of Corrections, Mr. Harry K. Singletary Jr., called me on the phone and said, "Ron, I would like for you to take over Florida State Prison. I'd like for you to be the warden there. It's an enormous responsibility." He said, "I need someone who's very strong and can handle that place. But I have one question I must ask you. Will you have any problems," he said, "carrying out the death penalty?" And my response was very quick and very sure. I said, "No, sir."
But very quickly after starting his new job at this prison, McAndrew told us how the first seeds of doubt about the justice of the death penalty were planted in his mind.
I started practicing with the death team on carrying out the death penalty. But a few things started happening that I had not counted on. I never realized that I would be the person to meet the family of the condemned and also the family and friends of the victim, or at least the alleged victim. I found myself reading the investigation that had sent this man to death row. As a past investigator, having investigated hundreds of crimes, including murder, I found the investigation rather weak, and I couldn't understand how a jury could have sent this particular individual to death row. I asked an attorney friend who worked in this field, and he told me, "Ron, don't read that." He said, it'll only mess up your mind, because he said, quite frankly, there's no justice in our courts in terms of the death penalty. He said, it's simply a question of which attorney is the best actor and the best convincing attorney in terms of telling the jury their side of the story.
As MacAndrew went on to explain, it was precisely the close contact he had with the families of both the condemned and of the murder victim that provided him with his first moral awakening.
First execution, my first moral shock. I found the mother and two sisters of the condemned waiting to see me outside of my office one morning. And I had a policy of seeing everyone, so I invited them into my office. And I sat across from these three women, and I could tell that they were horribly distressed because someone that they loved very much was about to be killed, purposefully killed. We have some questions, and will I be able to see my brother? The sister told me, and I said, of course, and I said, I'll bend the rules as much as I can to allow you to visit as often as possible. But when the mother looked me straight in the eye, with tears streaming down her face, and she said, Warden, I just have one question. Will I be able to hug my baby before y'all kill him? That hit me like a ton of bricks. And, she left me with an uneasy feeling. I felt my conscience crawling right up my back. I found myself getting to know the prisoner, the condemned. I saw him at his cell every day. I carried messages from his attorney. I realized suddenly that this was not so mechanical. It was not so administrative. It was getting very personal. I then had the sister of the victim, who was very angry and full of hate, and she was looking for revenge. She asked me, she said, Warden, I want to go to that execution. I said, yes, ma'am, I'll approve that. She said, I want a front row seat. I want to sit right in front of the electric chair. I want to watch this man burn to death.
He shares with us his memories of what happened on the day of the first execution he was in charge of supervising in the Florida State Prison.
The morning of the execution, I thought it would be very automatic, very easy. I went to the death cell. I sat on the bed next to the inmate, and I told him, I said, I hate to do this, but the law requires me to. I said, I have to read you your death warrant. I just said, it's signed by the governor and by the attorney general. And I started reading, and it's a rather long document. And I started reading this, and about halfway through the death warrant, the prisoner who was handcuffed and sitting next to me, he could tell I was having a hard time getting the words out. And he sort of elbowed me a little bit with his left elbow. He said, it's okay, Warden. I'm ready. He said, I've made my peace with God. Here, I'm about to kill him, and he's trying to make it easy for me. It told me very quickly which of us was the strongest, because I didn't have that kind of nerve. But I took this man into the death chamber. I put him to death. I watched the family member of the victim stare with hate all across her face throughout the execution, with her arms crossed, very angry look, and the condemned was concentrating so strongly on his final prayer that I don't think he even noticed her. I don't think he noticed any of the witnesses.
One of the most pivotal and most shocking executions he witnessed at the Florida State Prison came when, due to a malfunction, flames shot out from the face and head of the condemned man when the electrical current was applied to him in the electric chair. The prisoner in question at that botched execution was a Cuban refugee called Pedro Medina. MacAndrew told us more about that gruesome incident in which he saw Medina literally being burnt alive.
This man had no education. He had serious mental problems. He certainly did not know how to interact socially any place with anyone. He had lived a wild life on the streets and a wild life in prisons. He needed psychological help more than anything else. But I went through the same process, took Pedro Medina into the death chamber. I remember watching the engineer remove the sponge from the saline solution and squeeze it before he put it on Pedro Medina's head just before the execution. And I questioned the amount of water he had squeezed out of the sponge. But the chief electrician said it was fine. Everything's fine, he said. So when I gave the order to the executioner to turn on the electricity, there was an immediate fire. A flame dipped down out of a copper helmet on Pedro Medina's head and came straight up in front of my face. His head was on fire. I was aghast. So was everybody else. The electrician, who was wearing the big heavy gloves and had the the capability of removing the helmet, asked me if we should continue. There's no way I could stop. And I told him to continue. I walked out of that death chamber that day knowing that I had personally helped burn a human being to death, burn him to death. I hoped, but somehow in the back of my mind, I still supported the death penalty. And today I can't understand why, but I did. The governor was very angry about the fire. He actually fired me and rehired me in the same day and then ordered me to go to Texas and to learn how to do lethal injections. So I went to Huntsville, Texas, and I worked with the death team there for 5 lethal injections. I brought all of this knowledge back to Florida, purchased all of the equipment, and got Florida prepared for the new way of killing people who had possibly killed other people.
But it wasn't just that botched execution that was causing McAndrew to grow increasingly uneasy about the use of the death penalty. He says cases involving the wrongful convictions of a number of men on death row often kept him awake at night.
Sometimes people are wrongfully convicted. I had an experience that keeps me awake at nights. I went to speak in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania about 2 years ago, and I was one of the guest speakers there, and I was walking down the hallway of the large hotel where we were all staying. And I saw a man standing there in the middle of the foyer, and he looked familiar to me. And I saw him look at me, and he opened his arms up, and he wrapped his arms around me, and he gave me a big hug. That was Mr. Juan Melendez. The last time I had seen Melendez was he was in a prison cell at Florida State Prison, and he was on death row. He was found innocent and removed. When I laid down in my bed that night and I tried to close my eyes, I had this vision of me taking Juan into the death chamber and putting him in the electric chair and killing him. And there he's totally innocent of all crimes. He's a wonderful man who should never have gone to prison, but he had a crooked sheriff who was running for election. He needed to catch somebody doing a big crime to get his name in the newspapers. So the sheriff succeeded in what he wanted to do. And this poor man who had come to Florida from Puerto Rico found himself sitting on Florida's death row for 20 years. What a horrible thing to happen.
McAndrew told us he prays just as hard for murder victims as he does for the condemned prisoner. And as he goes on to explain, there are special reasons for that.
There's murder in my own family. My sister-in-law, Linda McAndrew, was murdered in Charlotte, North Carolina in the year 1990. We miss her very much. She was a precious part of our family. She was killed by a horrible man who later committed suicide in prison himself. Today, I find myself praying for him just as I pray for my sister-in-law, because that's the right thing to do. That's the moral thing to do.
McAndrew asked for and gained a transfer away from the state prison in Florida to one in Orlando and started to examine his conscience more and more deeply until one day he realized that he could no longer support the death penalty.
I really did some very serious soul searching about why we were killing people who had possibly killed other people to show our children that killing was the right thing to do, or more appropriately, the wrong thing to do. I had been attending Mass for a long time with my wife, more to please her than to please God. But I found myself at a Mass shortly after that, and as we prayed, something I normally didn't do, I found myself asking God to forgive me for ever having taken part in the death penalty or for having ever supported it. And I knew that day that there was no way, no way on God's good earth that I could ever, ever again support the death penalty.
Since that pivotal day in his life, McAndrew has become one of the leading activists against the death penalty in the US and now lectures and campaigns against it throughout the nation. And it wasn't by chance that his change of view on capital punishment coincided with his decision to join the Catholic Church.
The death penalty in the United States is there for one reason and one reason only. It's a political tool. Politicians know that statistics showed that approximately 70% of Americans support the death penalty, just as I did, and probably for the same reasons that I did, simply because it's out of sight, it's out of mind, and they've been told since they were little kids that this is the right thing to do. So if a politician looks at these figures, he says to himself, well, am I going to go for 30% of the votes, or am I going to go for 70% of the votes? If I'm asked if I support the death penalty, I'm going for 70%. So even politicians that I've known in the past who are Catholic men who should not be supporting the death penalty because they know that the church tells them that it's wrong, they still do. I can tell you that this process that I went through in terms of examining my conscience and going to Mass, I was not a Catholic man. I simply attended Mass because my wife is a lifelong Catholic. But through this process, I found myself sitting with a priest. I thought I could just walk into his office and say, Father Joe, I'd like to become a Catholic. Can you sign me up? And I found out it wasn't that easy. I had to go to catechism, in fact, for a year and a half. And then on one beautiful Easter day, I became a Roman Catholic and a very proud one. And my faith has grown every year since.
I was speaking to Ron McAndrew, a leading campaigner against the death penalty in the US.
I just called to say I love you.
In the US, over 40% of marriages end in divorce. That's the depressing reality borne out by the statistics, and it's an indication of the daunting challenges many couples face in trying to keep their marriage afloat in today's secularized and high-pressured society. Successful marriages, however, don't work on autopilot, at least not for long. They need care and nurturing, and it's especially vital that the spouses keep the lines of communication open between the two of them. How many husbands or wives argue frequently or feel frustrated, hurt, or angry with their spouse? It's in situations like this that all too many couples believe that the only solution is to go down the path towards separation and divorce. But if married couples in crisis know where to look, help is at hand, and that help can often save a marriage. Originating in Canada, Retrovi is a program offered by Catholic couples and a priest to couples with marriage problems. Thousands of couples headed for cold, unloving relationships or divorce have successfully overcome their marital problems by attending a Retrovi program held in various countries throughout the world. Frank and Julie Laboda and Father Watt Bracken are American, and all three of them are volunteer international coordinators for Retrovi. Frank and Julie are married with four children and live in Madison, Wisconsin. They were pointed in the direction of Retrovi at a time when their own marriage was on the rocks and they were on the brink of divorce. They spoke to me about some of the reasons why their marriage was failing and how attending a Retrovi program helped to renew and heal it.
We had several problems, basically a severe miscommunication and working opposite schedules.
So the communication issues led to us living quite separate lives. And as we worked different shifts in our work schedule, she was working days and I was working nights. And I began an affair with a woman I worked with and spent 9 months in an extramarital affair with a woman from work. Our marriage obviously went further downhill after that, and we were separated twice and 5 weeks away from our final divorce when we found Retrovi.
And how did you find it?
My mother-in-law, Julie's mother, gave her an article from a magazine in the States about the program, and I called right away and registered us for the weekend experience.
And was it really quite dramatic, the turnaround?
It was extremely dramatic for me, but I still had a lot of fear and panic and trust issues. But it gave us hope because the couples that presented the weekend, the couples on the team, had been through misery even worse than ours. And we thought, if they can make it, maybe there's some hope for us too.
Now, the program consists, I gather, of a weekend experience, and then this is followed up with 6 to 12 week post-weekend sessions over a period of 3 months. Did you already find after that first weekend that you were discovering where things were going wrong or where to pick up the pieces, or was it more of a question of learning to trust?
I think I knew where things were going wrong before, but I was always pointing a finger of blame at Frank. So the weekend helped me realize what role I played in the deterioration of our marriage. And then the follow-up sessions were integral in change because the post-sessions offered a chance to look more deeply at specific issues like trust, conflict, sex, forgiveness. And so that was really where the bulk of the change occurred throughout the post sessions as well.
I think for me, the weekend showed me what could be right about our relationship again and reminded me of the reasons that I fell in love with Julie in the first place and why we were together from the start of our relationship, rather than showing me what had been wrong, because you could see that in our behavior with one another on a daily basis. But being able to talk with Julie and communicate with her on a whole different level over the course of that weekend and then the post sessions really showed me what was right about our relationship again.
Is it a prerequisite that for people who go to Retrouvaille that both couples want to save their marriage? Because presumably if somebody's already given up on it, then it's hopeless.
Well, in our case, Julie had given up. This was her way of checking this one last thing off of her list of things to do before the divorce was final. So no, I don't think that both couples have to be committed to saving their relationship. As long as they're committed to spending the time on the weekend together, it could change their relationship just by being there together.
Father Walt Bracken is a Catholic priest from Chicago, and along with Frank and Julie, he gave his viewpoint about the strengths of the Retrouvaille program.
Before I go into what happens on the weekend, I think what is key, and Frank and Julie have already mentioned this, is the hope that is given on the weekend. The couples come there with a sense of hopelessness with regard to their own relationship. By listening to the stories of other couples, they recognize the fact that other people can go through difficulties as well and come out of those difficulties on the other side with a great deal of hope for their relationship. I think that is the beauty of a peer ministry. Peer ministry allows couples to tell their story of their misery, their story of their hopelessness, and how they moved to a sense of hope. And this is done simply on the weekend by three different couples and a priest giving a series of presentations. And the idea is that the couple gives a presentation with a priest. After that, the couples who are participating in the weekend are given a question to reflect. They do some writing, they come together, and then they share with regard to this. And through these series of presentations during the course of the weekend, couples are able to communicate with themselves much more deeply. What we tell the couples on a Friday night is we are not there to solve their problems or to work on their problems. What we do is work on their communication so that once they begin to relate to each other and to communicate to each other, then they begin to solve their own problems on how they choose to solve them.
Now, I don't know whether you keep statistics, but do you happen to know roughly what percentage of the couples who come to Retrouvaille do manage to save their marriage? If you have any idea at all on how successful this program is?
We've seen somewhere in the neighborhood of 75 to 80% of marriages at least continue on. Successful marriages, probably half. But they stay in their relationship up to 80% of the time.
That's quite a high percentage.
It's a very high percentage. And it's an experience that we see over and over on the weekend from Friday night to Sunday.
I just call to say I love you.
But what real-life anecdotes do they have of couples attending the Retrouvaille program whose marriage seemed doomed to collapse?
I can give you a story about a couple that we know. They were having difficulty. Of course, that's why they were on the weekend originally. They would do well after one presentation in their dialogue, and then they'd go back after another presentation, and they would find themselves arguing again. So on Saturday night, after the first presentation, they seemed to be doing well. After the second presentation, they started an argument and they figured that it was no use. So they packed their bags and they decided to leave the retreat house. Well, as happened, as they were driving out of the retreat grounds, there was a chain across the gate of the retreat house. And so there was no way that they could leave the grounds. So they turned around, they unpacked their bags, brought them back in to the retreat house. And long story short, I think this is God's sense of humor by having that chain across the gate, because this couple then continued to work on their relationship, not only on that weekend, but they themselves became very involved with Retrovi after this, to the point where they have given a good number of weekends themselves and a good number of presentations to help heal other marriages.
Do you know of any other particular anecdotes that stick in your mind?
Several, including us, but another couple that when we were presenting team on a weekend, this couple, too, was up and down and finally got in a huge argument and decided to drive home. And they had about an hour drive. They got about 10 minutes from home and decided it would be harder to tell their kids that they gave up than it would be to turn around with their heads hanging and walk back in the door of Retrovi. So they turned their car around and they came back and finished the weekend and completed all of the follow-up sessions.
And as far as you know, they're still
and
together?
And as far as we know, they're still together and doing well.
Now, coming back, perhaps, shall we say, to the general state of marriage in society today, as you all know, particularly in Western countries, the rate of divorce is incredibly high. Why is that? Why do people give up so quickly, do you think? What more could the church and other bodies be doing to try to bring down that rate of divorce, of separation between couples?
It has a lot to do with the family. John Paul the Great was right when he said, as the family goes, so goes the world. And so Retrovi and the church, I think, is certainly moving in the right direction to curb the divorce rate.
I just think it's so hard, especially in Western countries. We're so bent on instant gratification. And if it's not what I want, I'm going to take it back or return it because it doesn't fit right. And that's carried right over into our relationships. It's not making me happy, so I'm going to return it and start over. And it's greener grass on the other side of the fence. And in most cases, in mine for sure, you know, in being involved in a 9-month relationship with another woman, it's no different. The problems are the same. You carry the problems with you wherever you go. So you can choose to stay in the relationship you started with and fight for your marriage and work on change in your own personal life and in your relationship, or you can continue to throw them away and start with a new one. And especially in the United States, we're at the point where our society says it's just easier to toss it aside.
That was Frank Laboda, and you also heard the voice of his wife, Julie, and of Father Watt Bracken, speaking about the marriage rescue program called Retrovi.
I love you, and I mean it from the bottom of my heart.
And that's all we have time for today. Thanks for joining us here on Vatican Radio. And don't forget, you can listen to our programmes at any time by checking out our website on en.radiovaticana.va. That's en.radiovaticana.va. I'm Susie Hodges, and until next time, Laudato Jesus Christus.